Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
This episode is about the 1%. Not the 1% you're probably thinking about. That's the amount of venture capital dollars that flowed to Black entrepreneurs in 2017, according to CNN and Forbes. A reason for that? Less than 3% of venture investors were Black in 2016, according to Harvard Business School, and most of those in relatively junior positions. It is especially important that we solve the diversity issue in fintech. One of the pillars of fintech, the promise, is that it can solve issues of inclusivity and access to financial services and advice that can bridge the education and income gaps. Are we living up to that promise? These are major themes for the Emerge Everywhere podcast that launches in September. Today's show is the story of two Black VCs. They come from very different places, yet have some remarkably similar experience when their presence at the table is questioned and they are held to a higher standard to prove their worth. Arlen Hamilton, founder of Backstage Capital, raised her fund while living in her car. She shares more of the emotional story that makes her hungry, or rather, the desire to never let her family be hungry again, and that spurs her on. She's also the author of an amazing book, It's About Damn Time, available on Amazon. After the break, Mike Asam, partner at Midwestern venture firm M25, talks about his roots growing up in a very small, very white part of Indiana. Mike's firm always approached investing as an act of stewardship. They put their money where their mouth is, committing even more to building diversity and a framework for all investors to use when working to be anti-racist. You can read Mike's blog post on it at bit.ly/bediverse and M25's announcement on their site, m25vc.com. Links to these sites and Arlen's book can be found in the show notes. These conversations are critical. The feedback from the Black Banker episode is very much appreciated, but we want to move beyond talking and driving more action. I hope you'll take the time to read the diversity framework Mike put together and take action on it. One of my favorite lines from Mike's post, asking yourself who actually benefits from that. And I quote, "Come on, people, we all know what I'm talking about. And one of the best things we can do is proactively nip diversity theater in the bud." Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll drive the change that fintech needs to achieve its goals. Arlen, venture capital is, you know, when we talk about banking is one of my banker friends referred to it as male, stale, and pale. And you're hard-pressed to find a club that is more exclusive, more male, more pale. Well, except until you get into venture capital where it's like, wow, you even make banking look diverse. And fair statement?
Fair statement.
Yeah. And here, you know, in the roads into venture oftentimes are from, you know, Ivy League schools, investment banking, successful entrepreneur in Silicon Valley. And here you are going and doing, you know, some of the impossible. I remember the first time hearing your story at Anthemis's Hacking Finance when you're talking about building Backstage. Can you share part of, you know, what made you want to go do this? Like, talk about audacious and against odds and like, it's damn woman. Like,
well, I just saw something. I've always been this person where I saw something, it didn't make sense to me and I needed it to make sense. I watched a movie very recently, just a couple of days ago, called The Accountant with Ben Affleck. And oh, yeah. Without spoiling it, he has to make, things have to be, make sense to him. And that's how I feel, you know, and it didn't make sense to me as a Black gay woman that 90%+ of venture capital was going to straight white men. It wasn't that I had something against straight white men. You know, if you look at my Facebook, you'll see that I have an incredibly diverse friend group. It's just always been that way. And I've always worked with different groups of people. It just, I would have these conversations with straight white men, and they would say that doesn't make sense either. It just, it was lopsided. I think a lot of it was people weren't talking about it enough. And then I saw this asset class, or however, a subset of an asset class that I didn't know much about, And that, to me, seemed really ripe for a disruption in general. It seemed like it had gotten really stodgy and very safe. And what I understood about it was that it was supposed to be the riskiest part, supposed to be the rebellious younger brother or sister. And it was not living up to what I was reading and understanding about it. So I thought, hey, there's an intersection here where someone could come in and shake things up a bit. I'm not afraid to lose, and I'm not afraid to embarrass myself. So those two things are very valuable when you're talking about being bold.
And bold in overcoming obstacles. At the time, you shared with me that you were homeless and on food stamps, and you set out to go raise a venture fund.
That's right. So I had housing insecurity for most of my adult life, up until about 30, right before I turned 35, and I'm 39.
Wow. And talked about the premise of Backstage, because it's a pretty powerful platform that you were looking to put together, and it's continued to evolve.
Yeah, sure. So the idea was that there are certain founders, and there are many others who we don't invest in yet, but I focused on women, people of color, and LGBTQ because I identify as all three, and I wanted to start with what I knew. It was just like me saying, well, I've had banking experience, so I'll start with fintech. You know, it was that simple to me. And the idea is that there are these founders who, because of institutional and systemic issues and barriers for decades in venture, have been left out, overlooked, underestimated, but have done so much with so little. I was so curious to find out what would happen if you gave us more. If you gave a Black woman who had taken herself through an Ivy League school, was an engineer, became a CEO, and was able to do on $250K what most people would have need $5 million to do. What happens to her when you give her $5 million? Does she not dominate? This idea and thesis of mine was just too much, too exciting to miss out on. So I went out, had to start very small, $25,000, $50,000, $100,000 checks eventually. And now we're playing in the bigger pond. Now we're in the, larger checks. But that's where it started, and people thought I was crazy. They're like, you're investing in too many companies, A, you're putting too little in, B. I'm like, I'm seeing 6,000 companies, and we're investing in 2% of what we see. And you start to see that pay off over time.
And let's talk about some of the access issues, because I too have always looked at the disparity and kind of the deserts, the capital deserts around how do we actually go solve some of them? Because one, there's been a lot talked about that people tend to take risks with those they're more comfortable with, and there's this natural bias towards people who look like me or went to school who had similar backgrounds as me are like easier to take that risk. But I think it's a much deeper issue. Like, there's a lot more systemic issues around this. I'm curious which of those you've encountered, and do you have any thoughts, having been at this for so long, about how do we start to really level that playing field?
Oh, I have plenty of thoughts on it. And I don't know if a lot of those thoughts would be appropriate for this conversation. But yeah, I think that it's a combination. People ask me why? And it is, it's more than one thing, as you said. It is, some of it is very specifically a group of people who just don't have the same lived experience. They make assumptions. They think that other people are all people. Most people grew up like them, unless it's so, it's the media visual of a Black man wearing a hoodie and with his pants low, and that's what a Black person is. And he can't be in a suit, and he can't be a CEO. Some of it is very, even though I think it's a little pathetic, it's also a truly unconscious bias. And that can be turned around with conversation. I've seen it happen. I've done it for years. Just simply saying, look, let's talk about how our lives are different. And let's talk about how you may feel underestimated as compared to someone else, another white man, for instance. And then kind of just relating it. Then it kind of goes from there all the way to just straight up racism. Institutional racism, white supremacy, misogyny, homophobia, et cetera, that is everywhere. It's not everything, but it is everywhere. Pieces of it are everywhere. And when it is at the place you work and in the industry you work in, the fact that there are white nationalist police officers in the United States who have a known ring of communication tells you it can be anywhere. Mm-hmm. And so it's not everybody, but it's enough. It's like one is too many, right? And so there are people who are actively on that very, very severe side who are actively trying to keep certain people out of what they believe is only theirs. So you have all of that to contend with. And then at the same time, building a company, as you know, is very difficult to do under the easiest and most ideal circumstances.
Yes.
So I think where it starts is in like level setting and just acknowledging all of what I just said. Like just saying, if you're a white man, which I'm assuming a lot of people are who are listening, if you're a white man, just simply saying, by acknowledging that there is this racism, that there is this bias, and then that there is, that maybe even I have an unconscious bias, everybody does, mm-hmm. that it is harder for certain people, by acknowledging it, it does not take away from my value or from my hard work or from my work ethic. It doesn't take away from everything that I've built to say that other people might have had a harder time. If we can start there, so much can be built upon that.
Yeah. And one of the other places, something that really resonated with me, you talked about that, you know, mythical black CEO, female, you know, engineer who bootstrapped with the 250K. I think one of the other places we really need to address is access to the early stage capital, because you had mentioned before that 80% of your founders that you support have been bootstrapped or self-funded. Mm-hmm. I've got to think a lot of that also can be driven by, do you have access to angel investors?
Exactly.
Right. And if we don't go all the way back to the starting, because when I put on my own investor hat, and the things that we tend to invest in, I like to see it a little bit, you know, further along and some time and money put against it. And let's face it, getting something off the ground while running a day job without any outside funds, it takes, you know, that much longer. And you've hit on something else in previous conversations. When we talk about the double standard that can come with these underestimated groups, maybe you could talk a little bit about that in terms of the impossible to live up to double standard.
Yeah, the goalpost is moved over and over and over again. You already have someone, for instance, who did get themselves in a certain position with, let's say, a tenth of what their competitor or counterpart would have needed or been able to raise, because they were able to cobble together angel checks, no friends and family to speak of, but in this case, cobble together something and just sure will and grit were able to get themselves to a nice footing. And then I've seen people lose B2B deals, business to business deals, six figure, five figure deals, because the vendor finds out that they are not, that the company is led by a non-white man or non-man or something like that. And that sounds almost ridiculous and like I'm just pulling at straws. It's happened in front of me. So it's almost like I know a brilliant, brilliant founder who's a black man who is probably going to make me independently wealthy with his company alone, with my small stake in his company alone. And he will not put his own photograph on his website, because even after 16 plus years in business and having sold a company in the past and having multiple degrees and leading a team, he still knows and understands that there are some people who will not buy from him if they see his face on his website, because he's known that from experience. And so there's that, and then there's just this expectation of, I was told, for instance, that my first fund or my first smaller funds would need to 10x in order to even be considered viable, rather than, you know, somebody tells me needs to 2.5x or 3x, I can have that conversation with you because I've done the research and I understand that 85% or so of venture capital performs under 1.2x cash on cash over a 7-year period. So if you tell me I need to 3x to be just phenomenal, I'm going to agree with you. But I've been told I need to 10x. And I said, and I, my response was, you're saying that, and I gave them the stats. And they said, if you do less than 10X, you will be considered a failure because they want you to fail already.
There's that much of a gap. Now, is technology starting to level that playing field, both on the fund side? Why don't we talk a little bit about, you know, you now are a fintech of sorts yourself, mm-hmm. With what you've built out with your syndicate product. Why don't we share some of that? But I'm curious if you see technology helping, hurting, or being neutral when it takes, you know, some of that out.
I mean, it's going to be helpful more than it's not, just in, by the way, you know, the access that it gives people. Anybody can learn to code. I've talked to so many black and brown and women engineers over the past 5 years. I'm so grateful to know their stories, that it wouldn't necessarily have been that way a few years ago, even though, side note, more women were learning to code in the 70s and 80s and then dropped off because of misogyny. So that's weird, right? But yeah, I think it's better than not. But I also believe that it always is going to come down to humans until it's all AI, right? Until it's literally everybody's plugged in, their brains are plugged into something else. Until that day, it's almost like autonomous vehicles. People are worried about autonomous vehicles taking over, or autonomous robots taking over. But until that vehicle can, you know, park, get out, infer how someone is feeling and hand them the package, I think it's that truck that's speeding down the freeway is not going to take that place of that driver's. You know, I've had this conversation mm-hmm. about autonomous fleets. So the point is, I think that it's helpful, but it doesn't erase racism. I think there are ways that, for instance, there's this organization I just met called Raheem.org and .ai, either one, where they're helping with police brutality through tech and taking on a tech view of it. And I think the next 20 years are going to be very interesting there. And then when it comes to the crowd and the people, I think that's when it gets really interesting. I think when it's more than just 1,000 dudes in a suit and four cities in the country who have the purse strings, which is venture right now, and it is more like thousands of people who are citizens making decisions together, like crowdfunding and crowd equity funding, that's when things get really interesting.
Well, share some of this early success, realizing it's the very earliest of days of the Backstage Syndicate. You know, tell us about the platform and what you've already accomplished in these nascent days.
Yes, early days, just
literally measured in days, just
like, you know, literally. Well, I did a lot of press and a lot of speaking out after George Floyd was murdered on television, and we have to watch that and be traumatized and re-traumatized by that as black people. And I brought it to economics and to venture, as I often do. And I called out these huge funds that I haven't seen make investments into black led companies. I call them out because I'm hoping that they'll get better, not because I want them to be destroyed. I want them to do well. But in the meantime, I'm big on, you know, calling out problems, but also having solution ideas. I don't think you can get very far by just yelling about problems. So one of our solutions, it has been our new syndicate, our investing syndicate. You go to backstagecrowd.com. It's very simple. You sign up for it. You can either be an accredited investor or a non-accredited investor. So anybody can sign up. You're accredited in the United States if you make $200,000 or more by yourself, or $300,000 with your spouse, or you have $1 million in assets, not including your main home, or you are the fund manager for $5 million or more in assets. There's a whole bunch of things that I'm sure many of your people know. But then what we do is we put together 50, 100, 200 people, and they each put in $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, and we put together $200,000 round or a $500,000 round for companies. And we've just started, as you said. So we only have two companies so far in the accredited lane, and we have two companies in the non-accredited lane, which starts at $100 up. But we've already raised more than $500,000 in just a few days. And that is big. That has taken others months, if not years, to do. And it's a testament to the appetite for the companies that we have, the sheer value and quality of these companies, because we give a lot of diligence, a lot of information for each deal. It also speaks to the fact that people want to have ownership and companies, and they want to play. Why should the venture capitalists have all the fun is the question, really. And why not get involved early on rather than post IPO?
Well, I love the bet around, you know, I'm a thematic investor. One of those major themes, of course, being fintech. But I love your idea of you're betting on the underestimated. Yes. And I think, you know, of traits that I could pick in a CEO and a founding team, that underestimated seems like a pretty important one, that it's the right type of chip on their shoulder to go prove things out. And I'd love for you to expand on the betting on the underestimated.
Well, you said it. I mean, we call them underestimated. We kind of started this wave in venture and in tech by calling underestimated rather than just underrepresented. Yes, we are underrepresented. But when you say this, it sort of gives this connotation of like down and out, underprivileged, et cetera. I'm talking about people who are just as talented, if not more, but just under-resourced. And you're talking about people who will get themselves to the same place their competitor is or close to it, under-resourced. It goes back to what I said earlier. What happens when they have more? And it stands to reason that someone who has something to prove, I mean, there are a lot of people I know, including myself, who I do everything I do in order to make sure that my mother and my brother and his children never, ever, ever have to be hungry a day in their lives again, because I've felt hunger viscerally. And I literally wake up each morning and I say, what am I going to do to make sure that we never feel that pain again? And that is going to drive me to an explosive wealth, because I'll be overcompensating every day of my life from now on. And I'll be wanting to catalyze other people to do the same. So you take that kind of prototype, you take that with, you know, someone, imagine someone who also on top of that has an engineering mind or has an inventive mind or has, it just goes beyond sports and entertainment and media for a lot of founders. And you're going to wake up one day and look around and see that the landscape looks very different than it has in the past. You're going to either catch the wave now and understand it and see that it's coming, or you're going to wake up one day and be so surprised by who is leading the charge, who has the purse strings, who are making decisions. Things are going to get different, be different. Well, I think we're on the good side of that.
Well, and I think that is the most exciting part about this, because unfortunately, I don't know that we can make it so, you know, toxic for that extreme racist that they are actually going to go away. They might just shut up again, but it's not going to change their behaviors. But what we can do is drown them out. We can remake that landscape, that, you know, they become the small island in a vast ocean that looks and feels different. And they almost don't matter anymore. You know, they can take their attitudes, you know, to Facebook all they want now, but we've remade the fundamentals.
Yeah, you said it better than I could have.
Well, I doubt that. But speaking of saying things, would be remiss if I didn't bring up, you have a new book out. And yes. I absolutely loved when I saw the title, because I heard your voice in my head when I read it. Now, I often don't add, you know, voices in my head when reading tweets. But when I saw it was called It's About Damn Time, I'm like, and that is Arlen Hamilton right there in a nutshell.
It's About Damn Time.
Let's talk about the book. Who should be reading this book?
I think first and foremost, women who are starting companies, who have already started companies, who have ideas, who have felt underestimated, are really reaching out to me in droves, saying that they are getting so much from this. They're ready to start their company now, or they are able to really work out problems that they had. It's very relatable in that way, but it's also very actionable. And then something really interesting has happened. I knew something was going to be different when I was recording the audio version of it at the top of March, and the male engineer who does this for a living pulled me to the side halfway through and said, this is going to be a bestseller. And not only that, it's going to resonate with a lot of men. And he said that he had been working on dozens of these books and never had he paid so much attention to the content. And now what I, and that was March that gave me some inclination of it. And now it's coming true. So many men of all races are finding that there's so much relatable here. And it's surprising too. There's a bit of surprise there, I guess, in the stories that I tell. And I think it's very much so for anyone who has ever felt underestimated, for anyone who wants to have like an edge. I had a meeting with a bunch of wealth managers, like a couple hundred wealth managers a few months ago. And I said, do you want to know what some of your clients and future clients are going to be going through and thinking? This is your edge over someone else. And then in general, it's, I guess you could call it, it's part memoir, part self-help, and part business book. And I did not ever imagine it would be the self-help part, but that's what it's been doing.
Well, the book really resonated with me, and not that everything comes back to banking. Well, it does always come back to banking with me. I was looking at it through the lens. I was working on some curriculum for one of the graduate schools of banking at the time, and was thinking the most common complaint we get when we teach innovation at several of the banking schools is, well, I just can't change things in my institution. Not until, you know, I am in that C-suite, which means I'm old and have kind of grown up there. I can't make change, even though I can see the things that need to be done. And what I immediately thought of with your book is, you know, this doesn't just speak to the people who want to go be entrepreneurs and start something. This is really about anyone who wants to make change, but feels underestimated or unempowered to go do it. And that to me is what really leapt out.
Yeah. I would agree, and I appreciate that.
For those who want to find your book, by the way, where should they be looking?
You can look wherever great books are sold, but also go to itsaboutdamntime.com for everything book and elsewhere.
And let's close with, if people want to find out about investing as part of the Backstage Syndicate, again, they should be right. Going to?
BackstageCrowd.com. Very easy. Once you sign up, look out on your spam and your promotions section and look for an immediate email response that tells you what to do next.
Arlen, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to share that with us, and excited to see what's next for Backstage.
Thank you so, so much. I appreciate it.
Supporting contract employees and the gigging economy is more important than ever during the coronavirus crisis. So if you're a business owner, chances are at some point you're going to need some flexibility in your workforce. You're going to need to bring in some people with special skills, a freelancer, maybe a designer, a copywriter, someone involved in coding, setting up a website. You know, we need voiceover actors sometimes for our work at Breaking Banks. So where do you go to find the right experience, have predictable costing, and hire freelancers with proven track records and clear pricing? If you want a solution to this, go to Fiverr.com. Fiverr has the ability to offer meaningful resources to help small businesses transition into the new normal of the post-coronavirus world. They connect businesses with freelancers offering hundreds of digital services. You can work with confidence. You can search by the type of service you're looking for, deadline, price reviews, and more. You know exactly what you're paying for up front, no hourly rates or negotiation, and payments only released once the freelancer has completed the work and you approve it. 24/7 customer service anytime you have an issue. Find your talent today at Fiverr.com and receive 10% off your first order using our code BREAKING. All the digital services you need are in one place at Fiverr.com, code BREAKING. Again, that's Fiverr.com, code BREAKING. We're grateful at Breaking Banks to introduce Masterclass as a new sponsor for the show. Masterclass lets you learn from the best with exclusive access to online classes taught by masters of their craft. For example, you can hear from Chris Voss on the art of negotiation, Bobby Brown on makeup and beauty, Neil deGrasse Tyson on scientific thinking and communication. Over 75 different instructors across a ton of categories. There's something for everybody. For for me, you guys know I'm a super science tech nerd. And so, of course, what am I going to check out? I'm going to check out astronaut training from Chris Hadfield, his master class on that. How to become an astronaut, how to become, what the astronaut training is like, from leadership skills to survival skills. Phenomenal class and really some incredible insights. Check it out. I highly recommend you checking out Masterclass. Get unlimited access to every single Masterclass in their library. And as a Breaking Banks listener, we'll give you 15% off the annual all-class pass. Go to masterclass.com/banks. That's masterclass.com/banks for 15% off a range of incredible Masterclasses from masterclass.com.
Voice America programs are now available on your favorite connected device, including Amazon, Alexa, and Google Home. Through streams with Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio, listening to your favorite show is as easy as saying the show name followed by the word podcast.
Hey, Alexa, play Finding Your Frequency podcast.
If that doesn't work, try adding on TuneIn or on iHeartRadio or on Apple Podcasts.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
And now, here's more Breaking Banks.
Hi, my name is Dara Tarkowski. I'm the host of the Tech on Reg podcast at Provoke.fm. Tech on Reg explores all things at the intersection of law, technology, and highly regulated industry. We're talking about fintech and reg tech, cannabis and sex tech. Join me and thought leaders from around the world to discuss how to pursue responsible innovation.
Mike, I'm curious at what point in your entrepreneurial and your venture capitalist journey did you realize just how white it is?
That's a good question. I mean, I think it was somewhere after I realized how white tech was, and somewhere before I was a VC, you know, myself. Like, I think it's been a long time, but maybe the first time I experienced this was when I got to spend time as a fellow for a firm, a VC firm, and realized that I was the only person in my class. I was the only person I met through the program, and it was kind of in line with a lot of my other previous tech experiences as well.
Was it always painfully obvious in terms of the experience? Did you feel, different, set apart? Like, was it painfully obvious to you, like, all the time? And I'm wondering, was it painfully obvious to all of the white men in the room? Because I'm going to guess it was also a male-dominated class. That when you looked around, like, did they even notice?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just something I'd become numb to, honestly, right? I mean, I grew up in Indiana. I grew up in a, you know, particularly white part of Indiana, if that's even fair to say. And just going through my career, I think it's something that we'd all become aware of and become somewhat numb to. I think the point that it became strikingly painfully obvious was when I had my first year as a VC. I had an institutional LP just flat out tell me, hey, buckle up, you're going to be ready to speak on a lot of panels.
I thought you were going to tell a negative story. When you said buckle up, I'm like, oh man, because some of these conversations we've been having, like, my jaw just keeps dropping, where it's like, when people tell me, it's like, you know, on the episode of The Black Banker with Tyrone telling me when he was at Merrill Lynch, they flat out told him that he should introduce himself as Tyler. I'm like, no, they didn't say that. He goes, no, they told me that you sound too black and no one's going to want to, like, trust you to manage their money. So it, you know, at least there is a positive outcome. And you do a great job speaking on panels, by the way, and not just because you're a strikingly handsome black man, but you do have a lot to say. You know, I think that adds perspective. And one of the things that I love that you've said recently is in your writing, the post you did for VentureBeat around venture capitalists should be stewards. So just give your philosophy around the investing piece of this, because I think it's a very different perspective.
Yeah. I mean, in that piece, I think what I really get to is you know, people look at venture as, you know, what it is. It's within finance, right? It's a financial practice, you know, where we're here investing capital with the goal of returning capital. And, you know, it's funny, my wife laughed, literally out loud laughed at me last week because she was reminded that I work in finance because of the way I actually talk about my work and the things we're doing. But for me, it's really about people driving value where it doesn't previously exist. And understanding that for people to create value like that, it takes insane amount of resources and effort, and just having respect for and stewarding those resources, not just of your own as a VC, but of those as a founder, because not doing so can put people, especially founders, in positions of nightmares, dumpster fire situations. So,
well, and have both seen those and gone through those, but you also, you know, you talk about being a steward, not a master. At the same time, though, you serve LPs, right? The limited partners who give you the capital don't always view themselves as stewards. You know, that puts you in a bit of a dilemma.
Right. No, it is a dilemma. It's a two-way street. And I think in order for this to function, I think you have to have LPs that have an understanding that, like, you know, we're risk capital, one. This isn't, you know, we're not investing in public markets. There's very limited objective data about the companies we're investing anyway. And there is an art in it that goes along with the science of venture. And so I think a lot of LPs have to get comfortable with the fact, at least with me and me managing an expectation of, in order to for this to work long-term, we have to believe in a long-term strategy that provides, you know, outsized long-term incentives. And that might feel a little less 1 + 1 = 2 in the moment, because hopefully 1 + 1 = 17 10 years from now.
17, lofty goals. So how do you think your experience, and I'm curious, which of them have been the most formative in shaping this long-term vision for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, when I look at what we're doing as VCs, we're trying to have outsized returns because we're making contrarian investment no one else does. When things become obvious, it's probably too late, right, for us to get involved and do something meaningful. I've always had to kind of preempt what's obvious, because when it's obvious, someone else has already won it or gotten it. I think as someone who comes from my background, and I think a lot of people of color can find alignment with this and resonate with this, you know, not very much is handed to us, right? And there's just kind of a natural knack for wanting to invest a lot of time, work, and effort early for something that you fundamentally believe in and prove it to a point that it's undeniable. And once that happens, you reap the rewards. But until that happens, sometimes you don't.
How else do you think being Black makes you different as a VC?
Yeah, I mean, for one, I think I have a big opinion about the power dynamic within VC and founders. I think fundamentally entrepreneurs, if entrepreneurs don't exist, VCs have no job. So in reality, it's really entrepreneurs that should hold the power in a perfect market. Now, in an imperfect market, VCs have capital and you don't. And so they have some power. But I try to wipe that away in any way I can, whether it's not doing a first meeting in my office, but rather on a walk, right? Or something that has a neutral playing field. But I think one of the reasons that I might be able to have a bit more of empathy from understanding that power dynamic is just simply the way I've been treated as a Black man in VC, whether it's as simple as going to an event that I may or may not be speaking on the panel of, okay. And being asked by an old white man, hey, are you a student? Or what are you doing here? Or in another case where I'm actually serving a company as an investor, and when it comes time to be asked who should be a board member, I have a founder literally tell me, I think you'd be great, but I don't think you would be able to command the same authority in the boardroom given what they expect a board member to look, sound, and feel like. And that's real, right? That's something that I think continually sharpens my ability to look at people with fresh eyes and an open mind and try to empathize and come as equals in any conversation I have.
I mean, I can feel part of that. You know, I was in my late 20s and early 30s when I was a VC and got that same thing. I can't imagine where the ageism is just such a small fraction versus the relative kind of disparity between having anyone of color in venture capital, right? You know, like Jung was only mildly acceptable. I can't imagine overcoming that to say you're young and black.
Yeah, it's interesting. And apparently people think I'm like really young, which is cool. You know, college was actually not that recent for me.
I'm curious the work you do with Black VC. Maybe you can describe the mission, what you set out to accomplish, and where you think we need to go from here.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty simple. We're trying to help more Black people get, not just get into VC, but advance in venture. You know, according to some recent studies, you know, over 80% of VC firms don't have a single Black person on their team. Less than 2% of senior level VCs are Black. I think across the landscape, it's still in single digits of entire people in Black. So really helping create, you know, enable more professionals of color to enter that market in advance. And we're doing that through Breaking Into a Venture program we launched recently, as well as different events and educational things we're doing across the country.
Where do you think some of those structural issues are that need to be addressed to create, you know, greater equity, you know, not just to Black, but representative of the whole to get within venture?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tough. The earliest someone joins a team that's diverse, the more likelihood that that team continues to be diverse in the way it grows and establishes itself. You know, once a firm is large and established, even if they hire someone who's diverse, oftentimes it's hard to retain that person, right? So I think just earlier and earlier in the process of getting people involved in a firm that's diverse, and especially in roles that are impactful and not, we'll call it theatrical. I mean, those are the key structural changes we need to see.
Now, on the flip side, is an entrepreneur and the entrepreneurs you serve, you know, it's well documented. In the first segment, Arlen talks about this quite a bit, the disparity in funds being raised by not just people of color and women, but Black in particular. The disparity is particularly profound. How do you think we actually move from theater, right? There's a lot of emphasis right now and funds being set aside, say we're going to invest in diversity, you know, we're going to invest in Black founders. How do we make that something that's structurally sound, not just the theater aspect?
Yeah, and you're speaking to the founders, right, at this point?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, M25, we've never made it part of our mandate to invest in diverse founders. It's never been a part. We're fully a ROI-seeking firm. That being said, you know, Victor's the only white guy who's like an employee of the company, like full-time, you know, my partner, Victor. We have myself, we have Abhinaya, we have Leandro, and our portfolio, you know, if you look at our most recent fund, over half our investments are diverse founders. And I honestly think that a key thing that people talk about with implicit bias is often implicit bias against someone, right? Bias against, but there's something about implicit bias for other people. And yeah, when you're a VC looking at 100, 150, 200 deals a month and narrowing it down to one, and you've got five that are objectively the same because you're working with no data anyway, you're just basing on thesis and who you like, you're probably culturally aligned with the person who looks and feels and sounds the most like you. And guess what? Path of least resistance. You're more often likely to pick someone that you have implicit bias for. And I think having diversity on investing teams, it's not just about discriminating against, it's understanding the realism of implicit bias for, as well as the networks that creates for you because of, you know, who you go to church with, who you go to whatever with, who you party with, all those things impact the deal flow you receive.
I'm surprised, knowing you and Victor, that you didn't have diversity as part of that mandate. From our angel investing, we actually added diversity, and I've been recently challenged whether I should have said it is equity, but we had it as diversity about 8 years ago. And not that we aren't ROI seeking in our angel investing, but one of our recognitions was teams that early on valued having different perspectives tend to do better in being adaptive. And we actually thought that was, you know, a positive selector, like you said, because, you know, we're placing guesses here at the earliest stage. What indicators do we have? And we thought structurally that was setting companies up for success.
Absolutely. Yeah, we do in the sense of the way we evaluate companies and the way we score companies objectively. We look at the team and non-duplicative skills, diversity of thought, all these different perspectives are valuable for us. That being said, there is nothing about us or our conversations and promises to our LPs or the way we've modeled our investment philosophy that says we're going to make sure we invest in X amount of diverse founders or allocate this much capital to diverse founders. That's never been a thing. We've just valued it, I think, in the way we've analyzed them. But similarly to you, right, because we believe it will drive returns, like the company has a better chance of success if there's diverse people involved.
Now, one place we haven't spent a lot of time talking about diversity is in the angel investors. But I think, you know, particularly when we talk about the Midwest is a theme, when we talk about the global ecosystem for tech and venture, the fact that the concentration of capital tends to be in, you know, the UK, New York, Boston, San Francisco, a little bit more in Austin, Chicago getting on the map, that leaves a whole lot of the globe massively underrepresented. And, you know, the first sources of capital you need, you know, really is angels to get these up and running. Is there a diversity problem within the angel investor network as well?
I think so. I mean, I think so. A few things. Angel investors in tech generally made money in tech. Like oftentimes, like they have a high propensity to do it if they made money in it before, right? And that's why I think you see a lot more folks that are angel investors based in SF than you do in the Midwest. Not that that doesn't happen, but it just feels easier. It makes more sense. They understand the risk profile better. They're willing to do it. So you have that piece. And as discussed, tech is inherently non-diverse. So there's a problem there. Then I think you also just talk about, you know, I was talking with Frederick at Black VC the other day, and I would say probably 90% of the companies that get to like a real full partner meeting with us. So that means they've gone through a screener and maybe a first partner meeting, have raised some money before in the form of like a friends and family round, right? And I remember hearing about these friends and family rounds when I was, you know, teenage, you know, in college, being like, what? People put money into these ideas like this, like $10, $20, $50, $100, $250,000 of friends and family. And look, not all white people have rich uncles. I get it. But, yeah. You know, all demographics suffer from that. But from as a percentage, diverse founders and underrepresented founders have less access to rich uncles for friends and family rounds. And so even just thinking about access to capital in the earliest stage to get you to talk to someone like Mike and Victor seriously is an interesting problem.
Yeah. Do you think that is solvable now with the money that's being dedicated to it in terms of this earlier stage and some of the theater, or maybe more generously call it the goodwill efforts towards larger funds that are trying to pool money? Do you think that will create, you know, a flywheel that starts with getting more money at the earliest stages that over the next, you know, probably takes decades of therefore more get funded by VCs, therefore have exits, they can return to that cycle of they made money in tech, they can invest in tech?
I think it's solvable. And I think there's reasons to be optimistic. I also think there's reasons to be skeptical and understand like it's going to take maybe a little bit more intentional design and thinking than just slapping a reactive solution on it. And one of the reasons I'll call out for that is just signal, right? Like you and I both know that signal is huge in early stage venture, and it means entirely a different story if you got a $100,000 check from someone who's discerning and sophisticated as an investor versus if you got $100,000 from some impact driven economic development vehicle that has to deploy capital and people that look, feel, sound like you and might not have any merit based on your company.
Yeah, the assumption being you weren't qualified to get it from that premium capital.
Yeah. Yeah. And signal in our industry is huge. In fact, you know, I've jokingly called VC fake finance multiple times before because how human behavior drives what we're doing for good and bad, right? But I think that there are a couple of things, signal being one, and I also fundamentally believe that separate but equal doesn't work. And just having these like small allocations for diverse founders presents some problems. One, there's a signal problem. There's the access to follow-on capital that they don't necessarily have that you might have if you're part of a normal allocation. So yeah, I think there's reason to be optimistic about it. I also think there's reasons to be optimistically skeptical and ask for nuanced thinking around it.
So if you could have the magic wand for a day or kind of take over the world of make-believe finance, that we're now in Mike's neighborhood, you get to, you know, play Mr. Rogers and construct the make-believe land structurally, or maybe not even just structurally, what would you change? How would you go about solving this?
Wow. Yeah. That's really tough. What I would do that's more, probably less process driven than that, is really look to help people understand, you know, what are they doing to make sure their top of funnel encompasses everything as much as possible from a merit basis as they can, so that the deals that they're seeing come through the funnel are reflective of the deals available, not just based on like proximity and convenience, but based off of like what's worth investing in. And how that happens is by people extending their networks through other diverse individuals or other deal flow sources, and then having a process that allows for an objective analysis. And one of the suggestions I made on a different conversation was, imagine yourself in your best state. You've met with someone that is awesome. You're vibing. You're kind of wondering if I should ask them to grab coffee afterward. Is that weird? We're having so much fun. And how you act in that scenario. And then imagine yourself with someone who, like, yeah, they're fine. They're probably a good person. I don't really care to hang out with them ever again in my life, but I'll definitely going to look at their deal. How do you act in both of those meetings? What's different? What are the connections you're willing to make with that person after? What are the follow-up tasks you're willing to do after? What are the little things that are likely to come of that wouldn't come from the worse off situation? And maybe enter meetings or discussions with folks that don't sound like you, with the assumption it's going to be a great meeting like that, and see if it drives you to naturally want to act in ways that are a little bit, lead to higher conversion, whether it's you investing them or you introducing them to someone who invests in them, or just some other way helping them on their journey. Because in some ways, I think a bigger opportunity here is less about figuring out the perfect process to implement across the board, and more about each person individually taking on the mantle of, I understand that so there's some people that I won't naturally have implicit bias for, that I might need to at least somewhat manufacture a little bit to give them, to put them on the same odds as someone else that just looks, feels, sounds like me.
So given that so much of this risk-taking is guest-driven, and we tend to take the guesses, the places we're most comfortable, you've hinted at that, and that tends to be on the things we have the most experience with, it feels like we've got, you know, these pools that need to be merged together somehow. That is maybe not an impossible task, but it's a hard one if tech is so dominated by certain groups that, you know, for me, I can only speak to it from, don't care, you know, race, color, creed. If it's in fintech, I know the space well enough. I can take better informed risks that are hopefully, and I do probably need to make sure I'm doubling down on making sure I don't have implicit bias coming into play. But how do we drive more of that? You know, that interaction, but where you can still leverage the fact that you have a great depth of experience and come break through your implicit bias against and develop a positive implicit bias. I like that you made it a positive action that it becomes a bias for, but how do you bring those two worlds together?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think you need to in any way like compromise what you're an expert in to just necessarily like try to make someone come across better. I think it's more of like trying to see the world from their perspective and mitigate the fact that their journey to that meeting with you is probably looked and felt a lot different. And, you know, I often find myself in a meeting, you know, myself, where I'm hearing someone speak to me about something where, you know, I get what they're saying. Technically, they're right. I would have articulated a little bit better. I'm kind of getting a little numb inside feeling about this. And I have to ask myself, like, is this because they, English was not a first language for them? And I just would feel better hearing this coming from the words of someone who sounded more articulate or sounded more like what I'm used to. And look, it's not always, it's usually not that case, thank goodness. But I'm just constantly checking myself all the time to make sure that what I'm actually receiving in a communication with someone is based on the merit of what they're saying and not like my ingrained inability or filter or screen that I naturally have based on the culture I grew up in and the way I speak and communicate.
I think that is a fantastic place to end and a great piece of wisdom. For those who want to read more about your writing or learn more about M25, where can they go?
Well, it's a weird link, but it's rirts.substack.com, or you can go to m25vc.com to learn more about our firm and my team and my partner.
Fantastic. Thanks for joining us today, Mike.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
You can listen to all of our more than 300 episodes, plus all of the other shows from Provoke.fm Media, and learn more about being a guest, a partner, or a sponsor, all at Provoke.fm.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.